Dear listener, before we start today's episode, I want to tell you about a resource I've created, which I want to share with you for free. I'll tell you what it is and how to get it. If you're not already writing tests for your Rails code, you're probably aware that testing can help you ship your work faster and with fewer defects. Because testing is such an in-demand skill, but since so few developers know how to do it properly, I've created a resource for you called The Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing. This guide is a short, downloadable book which answers the most common Rails testing questions that beginners tend to have, including, which testing framework should I use, RSpec or Minitest? What level of test coverage should I shoot for? What are the different kinds of Rails tests? What are all the Rails testing tools, and how do I use them? My guide covers these questions and several others. To get the Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing, go to railstestingguide.com. Now on to the episode. I'm here again with Matt Swanson, creator of Boring Rails. Me and Matt are doing a few episodes together, so I won't introduce Matt yet again because we just had Matt on the show recently, but I invite you to go and listen to the most recent episode with Matt Swanson because that was a good one also. But anyway, Matt, welcome to the show.
Hey, Jason.
So you and I are going to be talking about debugging. And incidentally, me and Noah Gibbs recently recorded an episode about debugging also, but it's a huge topic, and obviously just talking about it for an hour is not going to exhaust all the possibilities of discussing that topic. So I have more to say, and Matt, I'm sure you have a lot to say about debugging also. And I'll ask
why don't you kick it off, Jason, because I know that you... sort of have a big sort of manifesto about the ways that you systemically debug problems, and I think that would be good to start with.
Yeah, sure. So I recently wrote a blog post about debugging, and I called it a systematic methodology for solving any programming problem, and I'll put that in the show notes. But I made it a little broader than just debugging because it's not only about debugging, it's about solving problems in general, which may or may not involve debugging. But here's what kind of triggered me to write this post. I've observed other programmers trying to debug things over the years. I've taught classes and so watched over a lot of people's shoulders as they were trying to figure things out. And too often the approach is too unfocused and not methodical. And so I thought maybe I could be helpful by posting something that says like, hey, if you're trying to debug something, here are the specific things you can do and in what order. And I guess I'll just mention one more thing before I let you add any comments, Matt, is I kind of divide it into two big steps in the sequence, which is figure out what's wrong. Okay, let me put it this way instead. In order to fix a problem, you need to know what's wrong and you need to know how to fix it. Those are the two and only two things that you need in order to fix anything. And what I would advise is to separate those two things so that you have a first phase of figuring out exactly what's wrong and then a second phase of fixing it, which might sound obvious. But like a lot of times people, including myself, will kind of get confused and mix those two activities at the same time. And it's much more efficient, I think, if you separate the two.
Right. So you have you could get yourself into a mess if you're trying to like figure out what the problem is while you're also changing things to fix, you know, the problem, but you don't really know what it is. And you end up kind of flailing around.
Yeah. Yeah, if for no other reason than we have limited cognitive power as humans, and if you try to do both those things at the same time, you'll like not have enough room in your head to think about those two things simultaneously.
Yeah, I think this is really interesting just because of the way that you've framed it, and it sort of generalizes really well, and that you're not talking specifically about how to like debug a problem in a Rails application or like, you know, fix a JavaScript unit test. But you can see how zooming out and finding out and stating what the problem is maybe something that people jump over when they're sort of in the heat of the moment and they're, you know, their site is down or there's errors or they're trying to, you know, find and fix a bug deep in their system. And, you know, the real world is pressuring you to get something fixed and moving along there. So, yeah, I think it was interesting from that perspective, because I think a lot of times, especially more seasoned developers, they may be doing something like this, but they're maybe not cognizant of it. It's just kind of like automatic. And sometimes they, you know, skip the steps, and maybe they would be best served if they find themselves sort of mixing the diagnose step with the like solution step to pull back and do them separately.
Yeah, what would be ideal is, and I think I could even improve my own debugging this way, is if I had like a playbook that I could follow, where if I hear about a problem, then I could sit down and look at this playbook and say, okay, step one, here's what I do, and then, okay, that's done, now I go to step two, blah, 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 or maybe it's a flow chart or something like that. Because I think, like, the thing that I'm after is efficiency, because
yeah,
it can take, you know, it can take, like, 10 times longer or more to fix something if you don't have a systematic methodology than if you do approach it systematically.
I think it's kind of interesting when you said you think that this, you know, aids in your efficiency. I think that's probably true. But the thing that my mind went to was it probably reduces like the variance that you would spend fixing something. Maybe it's not in isolation the fastest way, right? The fastest way is probably like, oh, I'll just make a bunch of sort of wild guesses about what's wrong and like, you know, make my first change. And then sometimes that is correct and right. And that's maybe the quickest path. But there's a really high variance there that if you are not right in some of your assumptions or your fixes, then you could end up taking a lot longer. So definitely, I think this does, it sort of like standardizes the range in which you can solve a problem. It's like, I always know that if I spend, you know, an hour on this, I will like make some progress. Whereas if you try like an unstructured kind of approach, you may make no progress, but you may solve the bug in 5 minutes.
Yeah, it's kind of like working for a paycheck versus buying lottery tickets. If you buy a lottery ticket, you might get $1 million today, but there's also a good chance that you won't get any dollars for the entire year. Whereas if you work at a job, you're guaranteed to get a medium amount of money. Okay, maybe let's talk about how to diagnose a problem. So we talked about the two separate steps, the diagnosis and the fix. So let's zoom in on the diagnosis.
Yeah, I think it's interesting too, because they're both distinct, like they're distinct phases in this system you're describing, and they're also like different skills. And I think some people are better at diagnosing problems. Some people are better at, you know, knowing what an appropriate fix would be. So let's zoom in on diagnosing.
Yeah. So the first thing to do is just to state the symptom. And it's important when you state the symptom to only say for what you know for sure to be true. So something I talked about with Noah is that when you hear a bug report, that's the first thing that you need to pass through your filter of scrutiny, because the thing that somebody told you is wrong is not necessarily the same thing that is actually wrong. They could be mistaken somehow. And there's even a term for that I learned. It's called the presenting complaint, or at least that's a term that you could give it. And the presenting complaint is not necessarily the same thing that is actually wrong. And so if somebody says to me, hey, I was doing such and such yesterday and it caused this thing to happen, I wouldn't write down as my problem statement verbatim what that person said, because I don't know if that if what that person said is actually true. And so
it's just, it's like one data point. It's not maybe the final answer. So I really like that term. It's like very rich language. And I'm assuming it comes from medicine, right? Like a patient is presenting with, you know, these symptoms. And at least that's what I've heard before. That's basically like someone comes into the doctor's office and says, hey, my head hurts. It's like, okay, well, that's what they're presenting me. That's the first data point, but that's not the, you know, the root cause of, you know,
yeah, or maybe even a better example, if they say, I have a cold, it's like, yeah, okay, well, you think you have a cold because you have a runny nose, but I don't know that you have a cold just because you think you have a cold.
What are some of the steps that you would use to sort of, you know, like trust but verify, you know, what someone is saying? So I know in your post you gave the example of like someone you know, emails you and says the site is down. And I think my naive assumption was you would start with, okay, the problem is the site is down. But then you say, well, how can we actually verify that that's the case? That it's not a, you know, it's not a problem on user's end, or, you know, that the app is running, but there's some other issue. Is there a set of criteria that you run through there, or how would you think about narrowing it down?
Yeah, so I have not yet reached the state of writing down my problem statement, so I'd work toward that first. Right now, the only thing I know is that somebody told me that the site is down. It could be that something is wrong with their particular computer, for example, and the site's not actually down. And so I would do some investigation to see what is the real problem, and I would perform some tests, such as trying to visit the site on my computer. And let's say that I perform those tests and I determine, okay, the site really is down, because that probably is the most likely explanation anyway. But yeah, let's say the site is down. And at that point, I would not start hypothesizing at all. All I would write down is the site is down. So that would be my problem statement. And it's not very specific and it's not very helpful, but at least it's true. There's this passage of this book, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, which listeners are probably familiar with, that I included in my blog post. And I'll actually just read it because it's pretty short and pretty relevant. He says, in part one of formal scientific method, which is the statement of the problem, the main skill is in stating absolutely no more than you are positive you know. It is much better to enter a statement, solve problem, why doesn't cycle work, because he's fixing his motorcycle, which sounds dumb but is correct, than it is to enter a statement, solve problem, what is wrong with the electrical system, when you don't absolutely know the trouble is in the electrical system. And I think this is a mistake that people make a lot. They implicitly start with a belief that some certain thing is true, and so it leads them to bark up the wrong tree. So I try to be very careful of not letting myself believe anything that's not actually true.
So what do you think that would look like in like the software context, or this example of like, you know, customer reports site is down? Like if you don't sort of check it for yourself, you could potentially say, oh, okay, well, the site's down. That must mean like the app is down, which means that like the app crashed. So I'm going to start like looking at like crash logs. But you're saying that potentially, you know, there's a DNS issue, or there's a problem even further on their end, that like their internet is unplugged or something.
Yeah. So I always try to narrow down the problem area. So like I kind of think of a line with two points, and like there's one point where I have certainty, and there's another point where I have certainty, and then there's the in between where I don't know what's going on, and I try to minimize the distance between those two points gradually. So how could a site be down? All right. what needs to happen is a request needs to come from your computer and ultimately reach the server, and then a response needs to come back from the server to your browser. So assuming the site is down and it's not a problem with my browser, what's the first thing? Well, there's the DNS name needs to resolve to the IP address. And so that's the first thing I could check, is that happening? And then if that's happening, I could say, okay, well, the next place it gets to is the server. And so when it gets there, the request needs to hit the server software, Nginx or whatever. Is it getting to Nginx? Okay, if it's getting to Nginx, is it getting to the application? And so on. I would kind of trace that sequence of events to see where the problem lies.
Do you see like a distinction between diagnosing and like just trying to reproduce the issue? I think for me, a lot of times I would not necessarily take such a step-by-step approach, but I would say, you know, hey, the site's down, and like, and maybe this is just like in practice what I'm doing, or like my intuition is like the site's down. I would just like, okay, I will try to open it on my computer, and that will, you know, automatically rule out, or, you know, or not a bunch of things. Like if it doesn't load for me, then it's okay. Well, now it's not, you know, I can rule out the whole class of like, you know, someone's Wi-Fi is out or something. And I don't know, that to me is something that I'm not sure. Like, do you think about that?
Well, I definitely separate reproduction.
Yeah, go ahead.
I definitely separate reproduction from diagnosis, because just because you can reproduce something doesn't mean you know what's wrong.
Yeah. I guess for me, I feel like doing a reproduction is the best way to narrow down to like the problem statement, or at least zoom in a little bit closer.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And if it's like a bug report, you know, we're using the example of the site is down. That's like a pretty simple one to reproduce. Like if that bug is actually present, then all you have to do is try to visit the site. That's a very simple reproduction. But if it's something more involved, then the first thing I'll do is, okay, they said when they visited this page and clicked this button and then entered this text and clicked this other button, then the bug appeared. And so I'll try those steps and see if it does in fact reproduce the problem.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Like in some ways, I like this, and I think this is probably good, like general advice. I'm just sort of somewhat guiltily like thinking back on my own behaviors, and I'm like, I don't know that I necessarily follow something like this all the time. In fact, like sometimes I even do like the opposite of like, if I see that there's an error, it's like start like at the code, at the line that created the error, and like imagine like how could we possibly get into a situation where this would happen. And that's like, I think almost the opposite of it's like starting right at like the lowest level and then zooming out. But I think it just depends. Like a lot of times, like maybe I won't necessarily get a bug report from someone, but we just have like something in our error tracker that says, you know, this happened. A lot of times this happens with like front end JavaScript stuff where like something errored in the JavaScript console, but nobody sort of noticed that, you know, there was an error, so it didn't get reported.
Well, that's go ahead. I guess I'll go ahead. That's an interesting thing you bring up about like looking at a certain line and thinking about like, okay, how could we get into an error state on this line? Because that's something that's super common that I see people doing. And it could be the right thing to do under two conditions. Like one is like, if you're a very experienced programmer and maybe you know the system well, then it's worth taking a bit of time to just look at the code and say, okay, what's going wrong here? But for a lot of developers, especially newer developers who are maybe not that experienced with programming yet, maybe not that experienced with the system they're working on, it's usually really wasteful to sit there and look at the code and just try to think of what's going wrong. Because I have this principle that is empiricism is cheaper than reasoning. And what I mean by that is that to look at something and just try to think of what could maybe be going wrong is very expensive, because you're just sitting. Okay, anytime you like find yourself just sitting and thinking, that's probably a sign that that you're being inefficient. Because if you're just sitting there and thinking, then you're not uncovering any additional facts. And if you're not uncovering facts, then you're not learning anything, which means you're probably not moving toward the solution. So going back to empiricism is cheaper than reasoning, instead of sitting and thinking, it's faster in my experience to perform some tests and go. This goes back to the other stuff we've already talked about, like narrow down the area that the problem could be in, and then like list some hypotheses to say, could it be in this area or this area, and perform a test that corresponds to each hypothesis to give yourself a true or false answer to help you narrow it down more.
Yeah. I think I would generally agree. I guess maybe my tolerance for sitting in that reasoning step is a little bit more than yours. Though you did caveat it that if you are sort of someone who has experience either, you know, programming with these tools or in the system in general, you probably can save some of that.
Yeah, well, if you're good at it and you have a good track record of that working, then I think it's great. But the problem is that, like, I've observed a lot of people who aren't good at it. No offense to them, but, like, they just don't have the experience level or whatever to be good at that yet. And so it's a bad idea if you're not good at it.
Yeah, I mean, I think I sort of am struggling with the tension of, like, yes, I agree, that's probably not a good recommendation in general, but also that's how I would, like, act normally. Yeah, I think there's probably something to think through there, or to say, like, yes, if I find myself kind of just like autopiloting and doing this behavior, like maybe I could benefit from stepping back and following a more methodological.
Yeah, that's a hard word.
Hard word to say.
But this is probably one of those cases where the same advice doesn't apply to everybody. The right thing to do will probably be different depending on whether you have 15 years or 2 years of experience.
Yeah. Something that I think maybe comes into this is, are you familiar with the concept of like tacit knowledge?
No.
It's kind of like this idea that like over time you build up these sort of like automatic, this automatic knowledge that you don't really know how to even describe. So the example that they give is there's, this is often cited as an example. It's kind of a weird one. It's, there's something in agriculture called chicken sexing, which is where you determine like the sex of a chicken, and what's a baby chicken or whatever, chick.
Yeah.
And it's like, there's sort of like rules of thumb and like heuristics for it, but you can't really like fully write them down. You just have to like do it for a while, and then after a while you can like reliably take this really complicated series of like you're like looking at the chicken and like feeling around, and it's one of those weird things where it's like, yep, we just have like intuition, we can't really explain it, you just like do it a lot and then you sort of know how, but we can't write like a rule book for, you know, how to do this procedure. I feel like a lot of that is happening in software. So, you know.
So I happen to have read that same exact thing about the chicken sexing. By the way, if dear listener, you don't know about chicken sexing, you know, only female chickens lay eggs. And so for these like factory farms, the male chickens are useless. And so they have somebody who's a professional chicken sexer, and they look at all the chicks who just hatched, and they determine the sex of the chicken, and the male ones are all destroyed because they only want to keep the female ones. But yeah, like you said, they look at the chicken, and they can't like communicate to another person how they determine the sex of the chicken, but somehow they know. Yeah, I think a lot of that's true. I think that's something that's just like, really true in general is there's also that term of like unconscious competence where you're good at something, but you don't know why you're good at that thing. I think there's a lot of that right. too.
Yeah. So I think, I don't know. I think the ideas sort of intersect a little bit because when I think back to how I act and behave sometimes when there's a problem I'm trying to diagnose or debug, it's like sometimes you just have like an intuition of where it is and you like, at least for me, I just kind of like dive in and then it's not that I'm unwilling to try other things, but it's like I have a good hunch or, you know, my brain is telling me that this is probably a fruitful path to follow and I will follow that and then not be afraid to sort of back up and invalidate my initial start there. But that's like, it's hard to like communicate that to someone or to really say that that's a strategy that you would recommend for someone new to the code base or new to programming. Is like, oh yeah, just like start by, you know, having 10 years experience of, you know, debugging problems, and then like you'll just be able to jump in right into the middle instead of starting at the top and working your way through.
Well, this is kind of what led me down this path initially, because where I work, we recently hired two developers, and I've, in working with them, like observed their debugging techniques and stuff like that, and I want to help them become more efficient in their debugging. But I found it hard to communicate how they could be faster. And so I had to start writing this stuff down. And some of this stuff, like, I already knew that I knew it, but other things, yeah. I had to write it down in order to really realize that, like, oh, okay, this is what, like the two steps of separating the diagnosis from the fix, that was something that I kind of subconsciously just did, but I never articulated even to myself that that's how I do it. So this whole process of writing all this stuff down and really even understanding what it is that I myself do is only something that I've done in the last few weeks.
Yeah, I think that rings true to me.
Mm-hmm. Something we could maybe also touch on a little bit is once you've diagnosed something, how do you fix it? Because sometimes it's easy. Like, in fact, quite a lot of the time, the diagnosis is 95% of the job. And once you found the issue, it's only like a one-line change or something like that to fix it. But sometimes mm-hmm. it's not quite so obvious. Sometimes the fix is hard too. And so here's what I would recommend in that area. There's kind of five steps. The first thing I would do is enumerate all the possible solutions. So I would list all the solutions I can think of without filtering for elegance or ease of implementation or anything else. And then after I've done that, step two is that I would rank those solutions from most appealing to least appealing. So I'd put the simplest, most elegant solutions at the top and the dirtiest hacks at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
Then step three is I would just start at the top of the list and try the most appealing solution. And if that works, then great, I'm done. If that doesn't work, then I'll go to the... Well, if that doesn't work, then I won't immediately go to the next step. If that doesn't work, I might start that process again because the act of trying to implement that first solution might give me some new ideas. And so I'll revisit my list and maybe add some things to it and reorder it and stuff like that. But I'll basically repeat that process until I can't think of any more good ideas. How do you approach that kind of thing, Matt? Do you do it similarly or do you do it a different way?
Yeah, I'm trying to think a little bit here. I don't recall myself ever. And I'm not sure how literal you're being with some of these. Like, I don't recall myself ever like writing out a list of solutions and putting a plus one on this one and that one and doing anything like that. I don't know. I think I just operate a lot more in the like the feels based intuition space, I guess, because to me, I'd also want to be thinking about like sure, we might know the immediate fix for this, but like, what's the other fallout for this? So like recently we had an issue in our code where we had just sort of like typo/transposed an acronym, and that was causing a problem, right? So in our system, we had something that was called like an NCD, and we also had something that was an NDC. And you can see how someone, you know, accidentally mixes them up and then even goes through code review and, you know, nothing jumps out because like that's also a valid thing. So there was a bug where the wrong data was getting pulled in. And so we were able to diagnose the problem was that, you know, we were using the wrong value. And the fix is like, well, switch to using the other one. But some things that went through my head were like, okay, well, what's the other fallout that we maybe haven't seen yet from this? So for example, in our case, we had some like audit logs that had the wrong value. So we also had to go in and like swap those out. And then we found that, oh, this typo had been made in some other place in the code that hadn't been discovered yet. And then I also would try to think about like, well, once we fix this, like, should we be fixing this in a way that prevents like other classes of this error to happen? And so maybe that's just further down the process than you're at the moment. But for me, it all kind of like blends together into this, like, okay, here's the problem. Then like, well, what are we going to do about it? And that includes like the solution, but also like, remedies to prevent it. And then also like, how do we deal with any, cleanup work that we have to do?
Yeah. So it sounds like maybe you're considering not just how do we address this specific case, but how do we address this general class of problems so that this kind of thing doesn't happen again in the future?
Yeah. And I think like, if I were to say on my team, like, okay, here's the bug, and I just like filed a ticket, I think, somebody else on my team may just like, oh, I fixed the typo, and then like it's done and we sort of move on. And while that does fix the immediate bug, it's like bugs exist in time, right? So while this bug was in the system, like what other effects did it cause that are not being, immediately surfaced here? I don't know. That's kind of how I think about it. It all kind of, like I said, just blends together into this, like, what are we going to do step?
Yeah. Yeah, that makes me think again about root causes and symptoms. So, like, you identified the root cause. It was that transposed acronym or whatever. But then you were also thinking about other symptoms of that bug apart from maybe the originally reported symptom. Like, I'm kind of guessing here, but maybe there was some behavioral problem as a result of that acronym. But then, like you were saying, well, the bug existed for some period of time. Do we have like some messed up data from that period of time as a result of this bug?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
So I guess I'm curious. That's sort of my approach. Like, do you think that your sort of steps or your checklist, like, How would you see that scenario going through? Maybe you could walk it through and say, like, how would you if you're following these steps, when would you be sort of confronted with that fact of like, well, what's the fallout of this, or what's the other side effects?
That's a great question. So my like formal documentation of my methodology is in its total infancy. And so that's where I'm at with it right now. But if I were just to think off the top of my head, where would I insert that into here?
Yeah.
It would probably be at the end of step one. So if step one is find out what exactly is wrong, and step two is figure out how to fix it, I think the bigger picture thinking would happen before the application of the fix, because it would influence mm-hmm. what you're fix is going to be. I think you would try to determine the root cause. I think that's like the first thing in any case. Try to determine the root cause, and then once you found the root cause, ask yourself, in addition to the originally reported or originally observed symptom of this root cause, what other symptoms might there be?
Yeah.
I think that's where I'd put it.
I think that makes sense. I think it's pretty easy to see how someone in this case could end up just fixing it, and then we didn't actually change any of the data or the logs or, you know, things like that that also needed to be adjusted, or other places in the code that we just hadn't gotten a bug report yet on. And then, you know, later down the line, you actually end up with an even more complicated situation where, you know, let's say 6 weeks from now, we have a similar bug. And, you know, for some of the time, the acronyms were flipped, and for some of the time, they were right. And now you have an even harder time getting to that root cause. You almost are just choosing whether you want to pay the root cause, like, investigation time solving the first bug, or like later on when it's already like one level removed, when something else weird happens and it's like, the root cause was that we didn't actually properly fix the first bug the first time that we encountered it.
Yeah, that's always the worst, when you like try to fix a bug, but then your fix was either incomplete or your fix introduced new problems, and so then you have to continue dealing with that bug some more.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's pretty much a summary of my blog post. We've kind of gone through the whole thing, and I'm hoping to expand on this. And if anybody finds this useful, and especially if anybody listening has anything that they would add, I'd love to hear it, because what I think would be really cool to do is to expand this blog post into something that's more book length, that you can reference when you're trying to solve a problem and just follow these steps. Because in general, I'm a big fan of conserving mental energy, because, like, you know, people say, like, I wish there were more hours in the day, but for me, I run out of mental energy way before I run out of hours in the day. And so I really try to do, like, everything I can to think as little as possible. And so even just for my own benefit, if I were to have a system that I could follow to debug anything that could save me that mental burden of having to think about what to do, I think that would be really valuable. But I'm not sure how interested anybody else would be in that.
No, I think that, to me, is probably my biggest takeaway from this discussion, is that, you know, checklists or systems like this can be a good way to reduce, like, the cognitive load of doing this. So maybe it's not particularly in the solving problems, but, like, something that I've been struggling with a lot, you know, the first quarter of this year, is that I've been having to do a lot of context switching. And I think that if I had some system that said, okay, well, when I don't know what I should work on, like, follow these steps, like, are there any code reviews to do? Okay, go do them. Or, you know, are there any bugs to triage? Is there any work that needs to be, you know, written out, or any stories that need to be broken down? I think that would help. And I don't have something like that now. And I think that can lead to a lot of, like, this weird, like, mental thrashing where you, like, end the day sort of, like, exhausted, but you didn't actually do anything. And you're like, you start feeling bad, because you're like, why didn't I do anything? I used all this brain power, but, so I think regardless of whether you want to, you know, print out a checklist for fixing bugs, or you want to just dive in there, I think it's worth seeing if this idea can be applied to something else in your work or personal life.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, I've recently transitioned from just doing coding all day every day to having a team that I'm responsible for, and so now my work is, some fraction of it is coding, and some fraction of it is pull request reviews and, like, creating tickets and all that stuff. And I haven't come up with a good way to manage my time yet. Although I've gotten a little bit better and, like, kind of gotten into a groove now. When I first started, it was just, like, total chaos, and it, yeah, like, wasn't working out all that great. But now I'm at, like, a stage where I'm kind of handling it okay, but I'm not being nearly as methodical with it as I could. So that would probably be helpful. All right. Well, I think this was a pretty good treatment of the topic of debugging. Obviously, there's still a lot more to say about it, and I'm sure it's a topic we'll return to in the future. But before we go, Matt, I know that people can go and find more about you if they go to boringrails.com or if they find you on Twitter at _Swanson. Is there anything else that you want to leave people with before we go?
Nope, that's good. Feel free to hit me up on Twitter if I said anything that you think is particularly brilliant or particularly stupid.
Awesome. Well, Matt, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Jason.